or drive I-89 to exit 7 on the Berlin Mall Road. We are just minutes off the highway. Twin City Subaru, driving to be Vermont's number one Subaru dealer.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Condon. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little bit of slice of sunshine out there, but the forecast, boy, looking very cloudy for the rest of the week. Highs in the 60s, maybe touching 70 on Sunday. Thanks for joining us this morning on the program. We're going to be chatting about the happenings at the Vermont Legislature in our first hour here this morning. We'd love to have you join us as well, too. We'll talk about some of the other big issues of the day coming up in hour number two, including we'll get our White House report, find out what the latest is in smoldering Baltimore. What a sad state of affairs there. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to chat about extroverts and introverts. Thursday, we'll talk about Cuba. There's a film talking about Cuba that we're going to be focusing on. Then Friday, we'll be back down at the State House. Again, our phone number is 244-1777. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger and John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer, both joining us here live in our studios this morning to talk about what's going on at the legislature. Ann, let me begin with you. Good morning. Hi.
Good morning.
So down to what probably is about the last 2.5 weeks here. So tell me, what's the big stuff left that has to be done in the next 3 weeks?
Well, the must-pass bills have to get through the Senate and then the House, and the capital bill, the budget bill, and the tax bills are all up this week in the Senate, and there's a hearing this afternoon on changes to the tax code, and so then it's sort of Bob's your uncle. It'll get pressed through next week. You know, there will be conference committees, and there will be arguments in the governor's office that none of us will be purview to about tax policy, most likely, and then they'll be done. And I think they'll be done on May 15th. I don't see any reason why they can't wrap it up. They don't want to be there anymore. It's been a long session. There wasn't a lot to like. The budget situation is awful for lawmakers. They hate having to cut the rate of spending. They hate having to raise taxes. The education reform bill is nothing to write home about. And they weren't able to do anything on health care this year because the governor decided to kill the single payer proposal. And so it's a very sort of de minimis kind of bill that's coming through. So there was no glory and a lot of pain. Mm. And so they want to get out of there.
Doesn't sound like you'd give them a really high mark either, frankly.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think they have really worked hard. And
Dealt a bad hand?
They were dealt a bad hand, for sure. And I think that they've done the best they can with it. And, you know, so what can you do? The state's revenues have fallen. Budgets have increased over time. You know, they really, at this point, are faced with the ugly prospect of having to restructure everything down the road. And they haven't really, they're beginning to tee that up a little bit this year. But that's what they're facing long term. Mm-hmm. And none of that's very beautiful. I mean, you got to have someone in a leadership position who's willing to articulate a direction, and the governor's wounded, and he can't really pull that off. And the people who are in the building, you know, are mostly soldiers. And with the exception of House Speaker Shep Smith and, you know, Tim Ash has shown some leadership in Senate Finance. So until there's more of a political direction in the building, until we have a better idea of what's going to happen in 2016, I think you're going to continue to see a lot of fallout from 2014 and a sense of that they're sort of moreless at this point. You know, they're unmoored. They don't have a leader to rally around in the way that they have in the past, and that's also had an impact on the feeling, the tenor of the session, I think.
What do you observe?
Well, I was, as Ann was talking, I was thinking that I'm actually a little bit surprised that Governor Shumlin has kind of come out swinging in the last couple of weeks. I don't know how you feel about that, but he's been really pushing the proposals that he made early in the session that the legislature basically dumped as soon as he, you know, put them on their doorstep. And now he's again trying to push the payroll tax
right.
that got nowhere and fighting back against some of the tax ideas that have managed to filter through the House and Senate. And it kind of makes me wonder, he seems to be trying to reassert leadership at a very late date, and the legislature is not responding at all. So it's kind of an odd situation. On the other hand, I do, you know, I agree with Ann that the legislature and the governor were basically, you know, given a big bucket of lemons this year, and they've managed to make some at least drinkable lemonade out of it.
Ann talks about there being a lack of political direction in the building. You agree with that?
Yeah. It's the result of the election, not only Governor Shumlin almost losing, but also, you know, what was it, about 10 or so legislators, Democratic legislators losing their seats kind of put some fear into everybody in the building. So there isn't any liberal direction. There's direction toward the center, but it's kind of everybody for himself, and, you know, there isn't any direction. It's more like afraid of moving somewhere that might attract opposition or pushback. So it's, yeah, we face some big challenges, and I wonder what's going to happen next year, too, because, you know, we'll be heading into a gubernatorial election, and who knows what the situation will look like then.
Mm-hmm. And has it been more difficult for the legislature to figure out how to spend money, how to raise money, or has it been about equal?
I think it's been about equal. I think that there are... I think part of what has kind of influenced decision-making this year, too, has been the great disappointment with Vermont Health Connect and the enormous sums that have been spent on that project. I mean, $200 million, the thing still doesn't work. We don't know if it's going to be working by the end of May. And that's a disaster that has really kind of muted enthusiasm for new projects in the building. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question there, but I think that taxes are very difficult for the legislature to deal with. They really hate raising taxes. And so, you know, they're desperate when they start looking at shifting from taxable income to adjusted gross income. When they start looking at expanding the sales tax, like both Tim Ash in Senate Finance and Janet Ansel are doing in House Ways and Means. So these, in my view, in my experience in the State House, are really sort of desperate measures, because The Blue Ribbon Tax Commission report came out in 2010. There were proposals on the table back then to create a kind of neutral, revenue neutral change in the tax code. There was no appetite to do it because there was fear that that would affect elections going forward. Now they really don't have a choice. And as John was saying, you know, what also makes this difficult is that there are more Republicans in the House and in the Senate. There are more blue dog Democrats in both bodies. They're independents, a lot more independents in the House who tend to be conservative. And that has shifted things somewhat and created an environment in which it's okay to make cuts. It's still not really okay to raise revenue, though, I think, for a lot of those folks. And so, you know, you see $53 million worth of reductions in spending, and it's still a 4.8% overall increase in the general fund. And so there are questions about how we're spending the money, why. You know, Doug Hoffer last week in House Appropriations said we really need a 20-year plan for spending. We need a 20-year plan for revenue. Mm. And, you know, what's happened in the state is that technology has... changed. We're in a global economy. We're losing population, and we haven't figured out how to move forward. We really don't know how to move the state future ahead in the future. And I think lawmakers are really grappling with that. That's the subtext for these more specific debates about what do we cut and what do we raise.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're saying they're just patch all the time and not really looking at, you know, maybe buying a new blanket or something.
Well, I think that's why you see the tax writing committees looking at ways to bolster revenue, because they see the erosion in the sales tax revenues. You know, typically we get about $400 million in sales tax revenues, and but the total has been falling over time because more and more people are buying goods on the internet, and people are buying services more than they're buying goods, and you know, people go to New Hampshire to buy stuff. So the question is it reasonable, as Tim Ash has proposed, to lower the sales tax rate and extend it to not only just soda, candy, and bottled water, but to consumer services? And that would hit, you know, people like architects and accountants and, you know, people who mow lawns and hairdressers and so on. So it's there are no easy solutions here, but they are losing revenues. At the same time, there are efficiencies in state government that could be achieved, perhaps. You know, maybe we don't need a Department of Liquor Control, given the problems that department's been having. Maybe we don't need a Department of Information and Innovation. Maybe we need to tighten things up at the Agency of Human Services. These are things that they're considering, too, because as the world changes, state government needs to change. And you know, it's a big dinosaur, and I think there's a recognition there that they need to work together to figure out how it can run more efficiently.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. We've been talking with Anna Galloway of Vermont Digger and John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer. What would you pick up and run with that?
Well, one of the first things that Ann said there was, I think, can't be overemphasized enough, and that is... Is that a double positive? And that is the continuing impact of Vermont Health Connect on the whole political atmosphere in Montpelier. It's not just about health care. It's had a big negative effect on health care and any plans to expand or improve health care further, even after the ditching of single payer. But it just hangs over the governor, and it continues to, you know, push his image down for the legislature and among the general public. In a way, it's too bad, because in many ways, healthcare reform has been a success. Our rate of uninsured has gone down a lot, but Vermont Health Connect has become the symbol for healthcare reform and for the Shumlin administration, pretty much. And
black cloud of failure?
Yeah, and it's still hanging, and the legislature is getting very impatient. The leadership in the legislature is talking about starting to look at options much earlier than Governor Shumlin is. And this whole thing, because at this point, for logistical reasons, you can't go to the federal exchange until the 2017 benefit year. This is going to linger through, unless they prove that Vermont Health Connect works by, you know, this fall. This is going to hang over next year's campaign,
mm-hmm.
and next year's legislative session and the campaign. So that's, you know, and this is the defining issue, I think, for Governor Shumlin. This is his one chance to come back from the brink and, you know, salvage either his political career or his legacy. If he can finally get Vermont Health Connect to work, he might actually be able to right the ship.
Okay, but why is Vermont Health Connect and its failure having an impact on things such as where to cut the state budget, where to raise tax revenue?
Well, I think it just undercuts Governor Shumlin's leadership and confidence in his management capability. And part of it is his own doing. He has put an incredible amount of focus on Vermont Health Connect, and he has made it the centerpiece, even of healthcare reform. So, you know, that's partly on him too. But it just, and when Ann talks about the lack of sort of direction and leadership, as long as, you know, Shumlin's, you know, wounded, there isn't going to be any real leadership. The way the state government is structured, you know, Shap Smith can do some stuff, but the governor is the leader, and right now he can't really lead.
And this idea that, that Senator Ash is looking at of expanding the sales tax to include services, this is not going to happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
No, it's designed for fiscal year 2017, which starts July 1st of 2016. And as you can imagine, businesses hate this idea.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a hearing, like I said, this afternoon, and I expect there will be a huge lineup of pretty important companies and associations talking about how much they hate it. But yeah, it would go in effect in 2 years. But what Senator Ash has said is that it's impossible to move the ball forward on any kind of tax reform in a session right before an election season. And so they have to do it now if they're going to do anything, and then set it up so that it goes into effect in the following year. So, or it could they might decide to do it in 2017. Who knows? But but he has made it clear that political realities dictate that they have to be thinking ahead a couple years down the line. And this proposal is not revenue neutral. It would generate about $15 million more than the current scenario. But there would be a $50 million savings for consumers who are buying goods. And the expansion to services would increase the sales tax by $65 million. So it's a $15 million difference there.
Okay. I was actually surprised how high the rate was. I remember the Blue Ribbon Commission was talking about a much lower rate.
Well, that's because the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission recommended taxing everything, basically. And that's how they were able to get it down to about 2%. And so the ASH proposal is simply to extend it to services. You know, the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission looked at taxing just about everything.
Okay.
You know, with the sales tax.
Imagine, I mean, it's going to be the lobbyist Full Employment Act when they start really talking about this. It's going to be unbelievable.
I mean, it included, the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission proposal included clothing, some foodstuffs. I mean, it was really extensive. So okay. That's how they were able to get it down so low.
So this year, how are they going to, you mentioned the change to the adjusted gross income in a different place on your tax form to apply the taxable, the tables. There's also this idea of removing some deductions. Are there any other big chunks here of how they're going to raise this money?
Yeah, so this is what Tim Ash is calling movement toward an adjusted gross income approach. And what he's proposed is an elimination of the deduction for charitable donations, and instead he's suggesting that the state put in place a 5% credit for anyone who makes a donation of $5,000 or more to an in-state charity. So you give $100,000 to the University of Texas, no dice. You don't get a state deduction for that. Right now, we're giving state deductions to people who make contributions out of state. That would end. And then he's also looking at a cap on mortgage deductions that would be between $12,000 and $15,000. And he says that this would affect people who own homes with a mortgage of $300,000 or more. Or people who have second or third or fourth homes with mortgages. And so he believes that this would affect wealthier Vermonters the most. The average home price is around $200,000. So that's the rationale. And this is a proposal that has also been considered in the past by the House Ways and Means Committee. So there's a lot of simpatico here. There clearly have been a lot of conversations behind the scenes between the two committees, or at least between the chairs, and they've discussed all of these things over the past 5 years. None of this stuff is new. It's just that they're dragging it out, you know, for a real proposal. But they've been listening to the joint fiscal office and economists and so on these issues for a long time. So if in my experience, this is not coming out of the blue. This is all stuff that's been worked over in a pretty serious way. Tim's proposal would also include an alternative minimum tax, which is essentially a required, a mandatory 3% tax on anyone who earns over a certain threshold, and I believe it's around $150,000. There are several hundred taxpayers above that income level who don't pay any taxes, and so he wants to make sure that they do pay something. You know, we have this very complicated income tax system. It's progressive. We have marginal tax rates, and it sort of looks like a wedding cake. So, you know, if you earn over a certain amount of money, you pay an 8.9% tax on that amount, but it's just the amount that's above that.
The last amount.
The last amount. So you're paying a very low rate on the first 20, and then between 20 and 100 is a much lower rate, and so on. The effective rate is around 3.5% for everybody. So it's, you know, people complain about our tax system, but at the end of the day, between taxable income, you can claim all kinds of deductions before you pay your taxes. So if you're wealthy, you can get around it. And that's what the alternative minimum is designed to eliminate.
So take a phone call here, 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. I'm just checking. I thought I heard one of your guests say that the overall budget is increasing by 4.8%. Is that correct, or did I hear that wrong?
Yeah, that's correct. That's the general fund increase, yep.
That's amazing. They're running a huge deficit, and they're increasing it by 5%?
Yep. Well, that's because, there were pay raises included for state employees, and expenses go up and so on. So, yep, that's the percentage increase.
Boy, they're not bringing that up. It's a good thing you did, because no one else is going to mention it. that's something that you keep hidden. Oh, unbelievable. Well, thank you very much. I'm enjoying the program.
I think it has been mentioned. People do talk about how much we're cutting the budget, and it is true, we're not actually cutting it. We're slowing the rate of growth. On the other hand, as Ann points out, costs go up for everything: healthcare, salaries, fuel. Fuel's a big driver of a lot of things in the budget. So it's hard to level fund a budget. If you actually level fund a budget, you're having to slash. And the fact is that unless we do some real structural reforms in the government, there isn't a lot to cut right now. We've been cutting, you know, incrementally for a long time.
Isn't fuel right now the lowest it's ever been? I mean, I can't remember it being lower. I mean,
should we
be getting all sorts of savings because of that?
You would think so, and the legislature is poised to pass a complete cut in the low-income heating assistance because of that, so maybe I shouldn't talk about fuel, but there are things that add cost to the budget every year.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, you go to the grocery store this year and next year, and your prices next year will be higher than they are this year. And government isn't immune to that. There is truth to the fact that, you know, what we talk about as cutting isn't really cutting. And I think, you know, as Ann said earlier, I think the legislature is starting to try to look at structural reform. But structural reform is always a painful thing, and somebody's ox is going to get gored, and they're going to scream.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about where things stand with the state employees. Also, we'll talk about the latest with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. We've been talking with John Walters of the Vermont Political Observer and Galloway of Vermont Digger. We'll take a short break back after this.
It's that time of year when potholes litter the roadways. Amy here from Auto Craftsman with 4 tips to help you protect your vehicle from the damage of potholes. Slow down. The faster you drive through potholes, the greater the damage and expense. Hold the steering wheel firmly so your car doesn't lurch out of a pothole and veer into another vehicle or off the road. Don't apply the brakes directly over a pothole. The car's weight will be shifted to the front of the wheels and could increase any damage. Proper air pressure in your tires gives your vehicle better traction and provides the best cushion between the wheel and the road. If you feel that your vehicle is making a funny noise or feels strange after an encounter with a pothole, stop by Auto Craftsman for a free 44-point safety inspection. For more information, call Auto Craftsman at 223-2253 or go to our website at autocraftsman.com.
April is one of the best times of the year to drive a new Nissan. Jack Castellaneta, it seems like everyone has some kind of sale, but even their sale prices don't beat a Formula Nissan deal.
If you've ever wondered why so many people are driving cars and trucks from Formula Nissan, come find out in April. Our simple, straightforward, factory direct pricing means you get more car for less money, period.
You're taking up to $5,500 right off the MSRP of select new Nissans, or get 0% financing for up to 72 months on five popular Nissan models.
Check the newspapers. Check the internet. You won't find a better deal anywhere. And our selection compares with some of the largest dealers in New England.
Straightforward, factory direct pricing, all the selection you need, and exclusive Formula Nissan discounts. It all adds up to April being the best time of the year to drive a new Nissan for less.
We're on the Barry Montpelier Road next to Pizza Hut and at FormulaNissan.com. Let us show you how easy it is to do business here.
Been meaning to try that great restaurant? Now's your chance. Vermont Federal Credit Union presents Vermont Restaurant Week, a food festival organized by 7 days, now through Sunday, May 3rd. More than 100 restaurants from all over the state will offer special menus at $20, $30, or $40 per person. Try lunch, brunch, and breakfast specials, too. Events include a panel discussion with local experts at Arts Riot, a culinary pub quiz at Vermont Sports Grill, a cocktail competition at Red Square, and an Instagram scavenger hunt. Parents, the Burlington YMCA is offering childcare Friday, May 1st and Saturday, May 2nd. 7 days Vermont Restaurant Week is sponsored by Vermont Federal Credit Union, Vermont Creamery, Vermont Spirits, Switchback Brewing Company, Woodchuck Hard Cider, and City Market, with media support from Jump On It and the Vermont Department of Tourism. Proceeds benefit the Vermont Food Bank. For the complete list of 100-plus restaurants and events, or to donate to the food bank, visit VermontRestaurantWeek.com.
Right, we're back continuing our discussion. We've been talking this morning with Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger. John Walters is with the Vermont Political Observer. You can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And toll-free, you can reach us at 877-291-8255. Jim writes in this morning, Mark, I really enjoy Vermont Digger and Ann's work, and I want to congratulate her on using the term reductions in rate of growth on your show rather than budget cuts.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Anything else you want to add to that? Let's change topics here. I want to bring in Bill Sorrell, the Attorney General, into this discussion here, another voice into the conversation, as they sometimes say. So, John, can you bring us up to speed? Where are things? Let's say I was out of town last week.
For instance, you leave town and suddenly Bill Sorrell is in trouble.
No connection. what's going on with the Attorney General? What are the accusations and allegations?
Well, some of these go back a couple of years, but the basic idea is that while Bill Sorrell has been very, very vigilant to the point of almost absurdity at times with enforcing campaign law, the most recent example being, accusing Dean Corin, the lieutenant governor candidate who accepted public financing, accusing him of accepting an impermissible benefit, which was like a $250 email blast from the Democratic Party, and seeking fines and restitution. Pardon me, my phone is going off, so I'm going to turn off the ringer.
You just have him call into the show.
We'll catch up with that later. My phone doesn't ring that often, so I forget to turn off the ringer. Sorry.
Was that Bill Sorrell?
Yeah. Counterpoint. Bill Sorrell has been very diligent about other people's campaign finance violations. At the same time, he has been very comfortable with being kind of loose about his own campaign finance at times. That's the short version. There is a much longer version, but I won't go into it now. And the problem is the way the system is set up. You know, Bill Sorrell basically has the final say on whether anybody investigates Bill Sorrell or not. So we have to take Bill Sorrell's word for it that Bill Sorrell is an honest guy. And that's, even if he is, that's not a good situation in terms of just good government.
Check and balance.
So, yeah. So, I mean, there are ways to have an independent prosecutor set up, but none of them work very well. It has to be either Governor Shumlin or one of the state's attorneys demanding it, but that's a difficult thing to do.
And the governor's shown no interest in even talking about this story.
No. So the alternative, and there's going to be a hearing this afternoon, which might be some political theater, with the Senate Government Operations Committee considering setting up an elections commission and taking away authority over campaign finance law from Bill Sorrell, which is an amazing thing to have happen. I mean, Sorrell has been in office for almost 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for the entire political establishment seemingly to be coming out against him, you know, the only thing I can think is that he's ticked off a lot of people over the years, and that
I mean,
everybody
this is
was
his
waiting.
Own. This is his own party that's doing this.
Yeah,
it's not like it's the Republican Party's in charge and they're doing it.
Yeah, Republicans, progressives, and Democrats are all lining up behind this. I don't think it's going to go anywhere this year because it's so late in the session. But just the fact that they're talking about it is a real slap in the face to Sorrell.
So what's really going on here?
I don't think anybody wants Bill Sorrell to be Attorney General anymore. You know, I've posted some very harsh things about Sorrell, and I've gotten some off the record, you know, back channel applause from quite a few Democrats. I don't think there's anybody in the party or particularly anybody in the legislature who likes the guy anymore. And he has gone after enough people in the Republican Party, in the Progressive Party, elsewhere over campaign finance violations in the past. He's made a lot of enemies. And I think his, you know, part of the recent revelations having to do with using out-of-state law firms to prosecute these big lawsuits that he's always so proud of calls into question one of the areas where he has really, you know, tried to base his political career. And it calls into question his competence as well as his honesty. Personally, I don't think he's particularly dishonest. I think it's more like he's been in office for a long time and he's gotten kind of careless.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, I think there are questions about whether or not Sorrell's a hypocrite. I mean, he went after Brian Doobie in 2010 for coordinating with the Republican National Committee, and now he's being accused of the same thing, and he won't allow anyone to investigate him. So it just, it doesn't look good. It doesn't smell good. And that's what people are talking about in the State House and outside the State House. And I think, you know, Anthony Polina, who's a progressive senator from Washington County, you know, basically said this tarnishes all of us in politics. Paul Burns of VPIRG said, you know, it may not be corruption, but it smells like corruption, and that's enough to get people going. And people are already cynical about government and politics, and this doesn't help.
Moment of your time for our friends at the Vermont Coffee Company. It is coffee roasted for friends. If you're looking for a great blend to start each and every day, you might want to try the dark roast. There's also a great mild roast, too. And those of you that are drinking decaffeinated coffee these days, they have a robust decaffeinated blend. Yes, real actual flavor, not just tasting like diluted regular coffee. You can find it at your favorite independent grocery stores, your favorite local co-op, and you can always purchase it online if you can't find it where you shop. And you can do that, and you can go to their website at VermontCoffeeCompany.com. That is the easiest way to send it to friends and relatives out of town as well. Vermont Coffee Company Coffee, it is coffee roasted for friends. Go out and buy a bag or two, and then
go back home and pick up the phone and call one of your friends and invite them on over for a cup of Joe. VermontCoffeeCompany.com is the website. You can join us on the program this morning at 244-1777 is our local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. Seemed like there was a real change in the last week where things stood with the Vermont State employees. When I left, things are really quite at a loggerhead here. And here, another case where I left town and things seem to have taken care of themselves. No, there seems to be a real change here, a little less tension, it seems like, between the administration and the union. A couple of new proposals out on the table here.
Yeah, the biggest proposal is a $2.5 million retirement incentive package that Justin Johnson, the Secretary of Administration, and State Treasurer Beth Pierce described in some detail yesterday for Senate Appropriations. And this proposal would eliminate 300 positions potentially and enable the people who take advantage of this incentive to leave state government with a little bit of money in their pockets. And it would also obviate the need to lay off as many workers. At one point, the administration talked about laying off 300 or more people, and now they're talking about laying off 50. The program would be available to approximately 915 workers. So there are a lot of people who could take advantage of it, and you don't have to be over 62 to do it. If you have a certain number of years of service, you can get a cash out basically per year based on how long you've been state government. So there will be some cost associated with it, but ultimately it gets at the structural problem, which is that over time the state has hired more workers. Since the recession, we've added 543 employee positions to state government, and that has a cost.
Pardon my stupidity, but
I've actually got a question for Ann.
Okay.
This sounds like a good idea, this early retirement option that would remove some of the higher paid people in each pay grade. Why now? Why didn't they come up with this like in January?
That was going to be my question, too. I mean, there was all of this, contention and back and forth. I mean, I remember we actually got a couple of listeners who said, why don't they do an early retirement program? It seems so obvious now, and they went through all of this to get to here.
Well, I'm not sure they've really achieved all the savings they need yet. And the administration wanted to reopen the contract, and they wanted to be able to lower the pay raises that were approved by the legislature last year. That's what they really wanted. And they weren't able to get that because the Vermont State Employees Association said, hey, wait a minute, you got to work with us here. We're not going to let you do that. You don't have the right to do that. It's closed. It's a closed contract. And so you saw the sort of browbeating language coming out of the governor's office saying, well, okay, we'll just lay a bunch of you off then if you're not going to deal. And but in the end, we're still not there yet. They're looking for $10.8 million worth of savings. And as far as I know, we're not quite at five. So, where the rest of the money is going to come from, I still don't know, Mark. I it's not clear to me what stones are going to be squeezing in the next 3 weeks for this blood.
Because you would think that they'd be talking about more layoffs if they wanted to achieve more savings, more than 50, right?
Well, maybe Jim Reardon will wave his hands around and he'll have an answer. He's... able to find savings in a way that no one else in state government can. Maybe he's got something we don't know about yet, but I haven't heard it yet.
Okay. All right. You would think that they would have told people what that was.
They're checking the sofa cushions.
Yeah. So what are you hearing on the state employees? Is this did the administration really blow it doing the negotiations this way, or was this ultimately the only way to get to where they are today?
I think Ann has a good point that they needed to start, and perhaps politically as well as managerially take a hard line and come up with the early retirement as part of sort of a fallback position to get the savings that they want. There is still, among the still Democratic legislature, there is a reservoir of goodwill toward unions, toward teachers, and toward state employees. There is a tremendous reluctance to mess with their contracts and their salaries and benefits. Especially since, you know, the last contract was kind of a make good for the cuts during the last years of Governor Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
So it proved to be very difficult for the administration to move the legislature on any significant bite into the state employees, whether you think that's a good idea or not.
If you have any comments or questions for our guests, you can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bethel Davis. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning to your guests. Given the previous comment that the governor's leadership abilities have been somewhat affected by the negative aspects of the medical thing and by the elder statesman, I will refer to him as an elder statesman, Bill Sorrell's status, I wonder what your guests think about the future of the Democratic Party in Vermont, if you exclude Shap Smith, who may or may not, depending on family issues, be involved. I'm just curious as to who might take up the gauntlet to not only run for governor, but where do you guys see the leadership of the Democratic Party in Vermont coming from at this point in time?
Good question.
Well, in terms of leadership, I mean, the Democratic Party is still in a very strong position. This is a left-of-center state. It is not as liberal as its reputation. It's not as liberal as Bernie Sanders. He just seems to be our patron saint.
Pat Leahy might argue with that.
Well, he's our second patron saint. Anyway, the Democrats have a lot of things going for them. And it doesn't look good right now. And I think if they head into next year's election with Governor Shumlin running for re-election and, say, a Phil Scott running for the Republicans, then the Republicans would have a real shot at getting back the corner office. It would be very difficult. It would be almost impossible for the Republicans to lay claim to the legislature again. There are just too many liberal districts. The state Senate is almost in a gridlock. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get any incumbents out of the state Senate. So it would be tough for the Republicans to actually take back control of the government. I think the best they could hope for, especially next year, is some sort of split. As for who candidates are coming down the pike, I think it's too soon to tell. You know, Shap Smith could be a very attractive candidate, although he is not well known in other parts of the state. But there are other, you know, attractive Democratic leaders. The question really is, you know, can the Republicans develop a bench?
Yeah,
they've
I mean,
got Phil Scott, but nobody else.
Yeah, the Democrats have a bench. I mean, the Republicans don't. I mean, you can look at Beto Weinberger up in Burlington. You can look at T.J. Donovan, who ran against Sorrell before. I mean, they're...
And the Democrats off the record are hoping against hope that he runs against Sorrell again next year.
Mm-hmm. And there were four Democrats running in the 2010 primary. I mean, I don't think there's a shortage of people in Montpelier, probably even just under the Golden Dome, to think that they could be the next governor.
Yep.
Anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest danger to the Democratic Party is a sense of smugness. I mean, I think they tend to sit on their laurels. They're not articulating a message that's really helping people understand where we're going forward as a state. And we're in some financial trouble. All those things work against the Democratic Party and could give Phil Scott an opportunity to win.
Let's talk about this school bill just for a moment here. That's the one you used the word odious in connection with this morning. I'm taking that odious is probably not good.
Well, you know, no one really likes it. It's a difficult situation for...
Is it going to do anything?
Yeah, you know, I think that's what's not talked about much is the fact that lawmakers agree that they have to get rid of the phantom student hold harmless provision, which subsidizes small schools in rural places and the small schools grant.
This is when kids leave, but they physically leave, but their ghost is left behind and counted.
They still count and the state still gives towns money for those students. And so what happens is you have large districts in Chittenden County and in Washington County who are essentially subsidizing little teeny tiny schools around the state that are losing population, that are losing economic base, and that simply just can't support their schools anymore. And, you know, I live in Hardwick, and we used to have more than 400 kids in the elementary school, and we're down to 250 now, you know, and that's happened over a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, and that's a big school in a rural area.
Yeah.
Okay. Like some of these schools are really, really tiny. And the question is, if these supports are removed, will they be able to survive in 4 or 5 years? And my guess is a lot of them are marginal enough that we might see 25 or 30 schools close, not because Montpelier's drawn a map and identified schools that should close, but because once taxpayers have to pay full freight for the cost of keeping those schools going, they'll be done.
Right.
You know, tax rates will go up a lot, and people won't be able to afford it, and they'll close. And so I think what you see here with this tax reform bill is that there's a recognition that the state can't afford to keep the subsidies going and to keep the small schools going. And there's a recognition that that Montpelier should do something to help restructure governance in these areas so that you have one school board that represents 4 or 5 schools instead of one school board per district, so that people can share resources and maybe look at closing some schools if need be.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how I think it's sugared off. But nobody likes this because, you know, it's painful. It's painful for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm.
And small schools are central to communities in Vermont. And once schools close, you know, the heart's gone. So it's really tough.
Is this a fair way to do things, John, where you sort of, I don't know, sort of the slow, it's almost like a slow death, you know, withdrawing food and water?
Pulling the plug. Well, I don't think it's politically possible to do it quick. You know, then you have everybody screaming about mandates from Montpelier and all that. I think the closest they can, the House Education Committee tried to do something sort of quick, and that was capping school budgets. And that proved too much for the entire legislature. This sort of approach, where, as Governor Shumlin and Secretary of Education Holcomb have said, we educate schools on the realities and hope that they will see the light, with some pushing from the state, is probably as radical as we can get in terms of going in that direction. So it's political reality versus what might be better for the immediate future.
Mm-hmm. The lake cleanup bill, any hiccups you see coming with that? They're going to figure this one out?
Well, they'll figure it out one way or another. They have to. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it this year because it's going to raise some taxes or fees or whatever. But they have to, because if we don't come up with a plan that passes muster, the EPA will come down on Vermont with some very, very onerous requirements on municipal wastewater systems, which is the only thing that the EPA can regulate. So, you know, if we don't come up with a plan that puts some actual money into water cleanup, we're going to have more trouble next year.
This philosophical exemption on vaccination seems to have gotten a little bit of a new piece of life here. The House is now, or the Senate's now passed it. Is the House going to pass this or not?
Well, if I had to predict, and of course, I'm never wrong. Shumlin will win easily in 2014. I would say the House is probably going to wind up shelving it for this year. It's going to be one more thing on a very long list of undone business. And as Ann said, everybody's anxious to get out of the building without making any more enemies. I was surprised, and I don't know if Ann has any insight on this, I was surprised that the Senate brought it back after it seemingly was dead for the year, but it's now before the House. It would be very easy for the House leadership to just say, let's not deal with this year. Let's let it simmer for another year.
Too many other important things, right?
Yeah, they can always claim that, and rightfully so this year.
Let's go to Sheldon. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning. The general public is very unhappy with the Vermont legislature this year. We wanted real solutions to real problems, and we're not getting that. And we know that it's the Democrats that are in control, and they are not listening to the people of Vermont. And they're doing things which are making it more difficult for Vermont small businesses to stay in business, like this service tax that they're talking about. This is making people very upset. The single-payer health care plan made small businesses very, very upset. And businesses went out of business. And that's what the Democrats who are in control of the legislature seem hell-bent on destroying the people who are providing the taxes to pay for the programs that they so desperately want. Not the people, what the Democrats so desperately want. And it doesn't make any sense, and the people are getting very angry. And at the beginning of the show, you said that the legislature is desperate, and that's the way we see it. They're desperate to find money anywhere and to hurt anybody that they possibly can.
Okay, let me have our guest comment. Thank you, Ruth. John?
It's very easy to talk in general terms about cutting spending and cutting government. What I've seen from the Republicans this year is that they don't have any ideas either. They have come up with few, if any, specifics on what they think we could cut in terms of fat and waste and abuse. It's not easy. And I understand the frustration, and I think that the drift of the Democratic Party and the leadership this year has not brought us any closer to real solutions to the real problems we're facing. We have to figure out how to run government without coming at people every year with tax ideas, you know, how to raise money. And so far it hasn't happened. And on the other hand, I will say that the legislative process is designed to move slowly and incrementally. That's the way we generally like things. If we came up with truly radical solutions, a whole lot of people would scream about it.
So take a call from Rama. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll talk really fast here, but back on the education bit, there's a bit of misinformation that gets out there, and it's unfortunate that it does, and it has to do with the school bills, either the House version or the current Senate version, which, by the way, still has to go through two more committees, so we don't know what mishmash they're going to come up with.
What's the misinformation?
But it has to do with the fact that the bills are about closing schools. It's not about consolidating schools, either the House bill or the Senate bill. It's about consolidating governance. And as a matter of fact, these small school grants are continued in both versions under different names. Not for every last school, but pretty much for any small school that exists that engages in approved of activity or, you know, these small school grants aren't going away. They're
all right,
just continuing.
Let me interrupt. Is there a difference between the governance and consolidation of schools?
Do you know more about that than I do? Anne?
Yeah, I mean, what he's talking about is what I refer to as restructuring, because it's basically right now you have a lot of districts that are very small. There are 277 in the state, and many of them have their own school boards. And what the Agency of Education has been pushing for a while is this idea that you might have three or four towns or three or four districts with one school board. And so that would change the governance structure in a serious way. As far as the small school subsidies go, there would be a phase out over time. It wouldn't happen overnight. It would be 4 or 5 years. There are lots of incentives that the state is looking at to ease the way.
Thanks for both of you for coming in. Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger, John Walters with the Vermont Political Observer. Find them both on the web. Thank you both for coming in.
That's
going to wrap things up for hour number one. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We'll check in with our White House crew to begin hour number two. Take your calls the rest of the way this morning. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush, FM 96.5 in Berry and Montpelier, and the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is coming your way next.